We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus on WILL AM and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Income tax returns are due next month. So this morning, three tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated are on hand to answer your tax questions. Marty Verdick, John Breen, and Ann Bushman are ready to take your questions. Join us with a phone call or by email. As time allows, we'll also take a look at deductions that are often overlooked, talk about tax changes that went into effect last year, and we'll get some tips for getting a jump start on the returns we'll file in 2012. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455-800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Marty Verdick is a CPA and Managing Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. John Breen is a Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. And Ann Bushman is a CPA and Tax Manager for RSM McGladrey. And Ann, this is your first time with us. Welcome. Glad to see you. We always have a great time, as much fun as you can have talking about taxes. So welcome back.
Taxes are loads of fun.
Yeah, right. Well, the deadline for filing a federal income tax return this year is April 18th.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, normally the 15th is obviously the deadline. It falls on a Friday, so typically it's due that Friday. But because of something called Patriots Day on the East Coast, which is a local holiday on the East Coast, business offices are closed in Washington, D.C., including the IRS. And as a result, the deadline gets extended until Monday, the 18th. Now, we're pretending that it's really still the 15th because none of us want to work another weekend. Mm-hmm. So it is technically the 18th, and the state of Illinois does follow the federal deadline. So you have until the 18th for both federal and state.
Okay.
But do your tax preparer a favor and pretend that you really don't have until the 18th and it's due on the 15th.
Okay, very good. And also, it's my understanding that although the state of Illinois follows the feds on this, some states are sticking with the 15th.
That's right.
So you want to keep an eye on that as well. So what are the rules for asking for an extension as long as we're talking about the deadline for filing? John Breen.
Well, actually, we just finished with a bunch of extensions yesterday. A lot of people are not aware that the corporate deadline is March 15th. And so we ended up filing a lot of extensions for business clients yesterday. But in essence, the way that the extension works is that you're requesting an additional time to file, which normally is 6 months is what you're granted. It depends on the type of return in terms of what amount of time is granted. But for individuals, it would be 6 months. But it's an extension of time to file, not pay. So what you need to do is pay the tax that you believe you're going to owe with the extension. And if you can't pay it all, pay something, pay as much as you can. The key is that you must disclose what you believe to be the tax liability that you're actually going to have on that form. You would not want to, file a form that says, well, I owe zero, when really you know that you're going to owe, $5,000, mm-hmm. because IRS could view that as a not legitimate extension. So the key thing is making sure you disclose what you believe the liability to be.
Make a good faith effort. Yeah.
Celeste, one thing with an extension, sometimes people will say, gee, I just don't have the money, I can't pay, so I'm just not going to file anything. And it's important for people to understand that the penalties involved are significantly different if we're talking about a failure to file versus a failure to pay. If you don't file the extension and you file the return late without an extension, the penalty is 5% of the tax liability per month, up to, I believe it's a maximum of 25%. On the other hand, if you file an extension, even if you can't pay the tax by filing the extension, that penalty now becomes a failure to pay penalty, which is only one half of 1% per month. So it's a, you know, it's a factor of 10. So even if someone is out there and they don't have the money, they can't file the return and pay the tax, either file an extension or file a return without paying the tax, but get something in the mail by the due date.
Okay. Now, does that hold for both the state and the IRS?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And is the IRS, and is the state of Illinois for that matter, amenable to setting up installment plans?
Well, the IRS certainly is. There is a fee associated. There is an installment payment agreement request which is submitted with the return. You pay a user fee to submit that request, and I don't recall, John or Ann, do you guys remember what the fee is for that now?
It's a lot higher than it used to be. Yeah. It seems like it's over $100, but I'm not positive of that.
I was thinking, fortunately, I don't have many clients that need to do that, but it's there is a fee associated with it for processing the request, and you basically put down what you owe and how much you can afford to pay, and based on the information on your return and what you've suggested as a monthly payment, the IRS will either grant it or modify it. And we've over the years, we've had a few people do that where they've been in a difficult situation and needed to do it. I don't recall ever requesting an installment payment with the state of Illinois, and I don't remember seeing that they even have one. So
The fee actually is $105, so I wasn't too far off with my original guess.
Okay. Well, I would imagine that, you know, with ups and downs in the economy, your situation, you know, can be such that you would have to turn to an installment, plan. Your business was in trouble. You were in trouble. That can happen.
There is interest that is charged on any deferral of the tax payment. So it is not a free loan. So you'll pay a user fee plus interest. So if the amount is relatively small, when you factor in the user fee, if you're going to pay it fairly quickly, that user fee raises the effective rate quite a bit.
Okay. This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this morning we're talking about taxes. Our taxes are due next month, and we've got three experts in the studio this morning to take your telephone calls, to take your emails, answer your questions about taxes. Ann Bushman is with us, John Breen with us, Marty Verdick with us, all three from RSM McGladrey Incorporated. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, a moment ago I mentioned the economy. And because the economy was so rough for such a long time, the Congress and the government decided to make some incentives for us to spend money, to go out and buy homes. What was the cutoff date to be eligible for the first-time home buyer, that credit in 2010? And it's kind of confusing because there was an earlier one.
Yeah, the version of the home buyer credit that expired in 2010 had a cutoff date. The home had to be under contract by May 1st, as I recall. John, does that ring a bell to you?
I'm checking that out now.
Okay, I believe it's May 1st, 2010, and you had to have a closing prior to October 1st of 2010. So the credit has expired, and John's giving me the thumbs up on both of those dates. So as long as the property was under contract by May 1, 2010, and was closed by October 1st of 2010, you were eligible for a credit of up to $8,000 as a first-time home buyer. And unlike the credit that was initially available back in 2008, this credit does not have to be repaid. This is free money. Now, the other thing that came about is there was a home buyer credit of up to $6,500 for non-first-time home buyers. If you owned a home and you met the requirements, you sold that home and bought a new home, you could be eligible for up to a $6,500 credit. My daughter took advantage of that credit. And, you know, that's a meaningful number. $6,500 or $8,000 goes quite a ways. Now, for those people who took advantage of the first version of the home buyer credit back in 2008, what was unique about that is it was effectively an interest-free loan from the government. The credit had to be repaid over a 15-year period, and the first installment year, the first year of repayment is 2010. So there'll be an installment of 1/15 of that credit that would be due on your 2010 tax return. So for those people, they got an interest-free loan. For people that took advantage of the 2009 and 2010 first-time home buyer credit, it's free money. you get to keep it.
Okay. Let's go to the phones now, and let's take some calls. We're going to go first to a listener in Charleston on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. I heard the word penalty, and I got to thinking about a situation where we had more deducted in taxes than we needed to pay, and so we get a refund. Is there any kind of penalty associated with refunds?
Oh, no, not at all. The only penalty is that you've made an interest-free loan to the government. You've overpaid, and they owe you money. They are not going to pay you interest on that money, and they will simply refund the excess. And that's true both for federal and state. Fortunately, the state of Illinois, even though they're not paying a lot of their bills, they are still processing individual tax refunds. That's not necessarily the case with businesses, but they are refunding the money fairly promptly.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in McLean County on line four. Hello. Line four, McLean County.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry. Got myself all spaced out. I was listening to the radio. Sorry about that. I have two quick questions. One is, you know the Roth you purchase and you can split it? And if you rolled over an IRA to a...
Oh, yes. Okay. All right.
All right. Sorry about that. What can you... How do I handle that? I kind of do my own taxes, so I'm a little nervous. I haven't even started yet because of that.
Okay. Well, yeah, this is actually a fairly common occurrence. For 2010 and 2010 only, if you converted your IRA, your regular IRA, to a Roth, you have the opportunity to recognize that income over a two-year period beginning on your 2011 tax return. The form that needs to be completed for that is a Form 8606,
okay.
And it guides you through kind of the calculation of that. It will walk you through if you have a basis in your IRA. In other words, if you had non-deductible contributions from prior years, that factors into this calculation. But for the most part, let's say that you converted $10,000 of regular IRA to a Roth in 2010. What would happen is you would then pick up $5,000 of income on your 2011 return,
okay.
And $5,000 on your 2012 return.
Okay.
And you would pick up nothing, in 2010, which was your year of conversion.
Okay. So because I did it last December, I will be in this year's. So when I do the 2010, I have to.
Yes, you would have to report that because you should get a 1099-R form,
okay.
That shows the complete distribution.
Right.
And unfortunately, the 1099-Rs that we've seen really make no reference to the fact that this is a Roth conversion.
Right.
So
yeah.
The only way that the IRS will know that is if you file the 8606 form in 2010 to tell them that that's what that amount was for.
But the tax will actually show up. I will get taxed on the, let's say, $5,000 this year and on the 2010 tax year and $5,000 2011 tax year.
No, actually, that's not correct. For 2010, your tax is zero. You include no amount of that conversion in 2010.
Okay.
You actually get a full, two-year deferral so that you pick up the first part on your 2011 return, which you'll file next year, and then the final piece will be picked up on your 2012 return, which you'll file in 2013.
Okay, great. No, see, that's why I was nervous, because I thought I'd have to figure out the taxes, and they'll complicate things way more than I thought it would. So the form is 8606.
Correct.
Okay. The other one I'm going to say it, and I'm going to hang up and let you talk it out.
Before you do, there's two comments on the Roth IRA. One is that you can... In some situations, people want to pay the tax in 2010,
mm-hmm.
And you can elect to report all of the Roth IRA conversion income in 2010 if you want to.
Okay.
And the other thing is that when you do report that for federal purposes, remember that retirement plan distributions, including IRAs like this, are not taxable for Illinois purposes, at least yet. So be sure and remember to claim that subtraction on your Illinois return when you do report the federal income.
And that is the next 2 years.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Great. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much.
You had a second question?
Well, yes, I didn't want to take up your time. We end up with some options that got exercised? What do I expect?
Okay. Are they incentive stock options or non-qualified options?
It's for my husband's job.
Okay. The tax treatment is significantly different. If you, first of all, if you were merely granted the options in 2010,
yes, I think so.
There is no tax consequence in the year that an option is granted. It's when the option is exercised and you actually acquire the stock.
Okay.
That then the tax treatment of that is determined by the character of the option, whether it's incentive stock options or a non-qualified option, and that's probably as far as we should go in this kind of a discussion, because it gets to be fairly complicated.
But
if you merely received the options in 2010 and did not exercise, it's not a taxable event.
Okay. No, we actually exercised, meaning we sold it actually this year. I mean, I'm starting to think about it. I need to probably educate myself.
Yeah. If you've got stock options, you really need to talk to a tax advisor that understands that, because it can be a fairly complicated area. It can also result in triggering what's called alternative minimum tax and alternative minimum tax credit carryovers. It can be a little bit dicey.
Okay, great. Well, that's great education for me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And next we take a call from a listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question on college tuition, and any if you can talk about college tuition deductions and limitations.
Okay. A general question or?
Just overall, what is covered under the education, tax, anything that is tax exempt or tax credit for education, college education?
Okay, well, I guess I can start the discussion with that. I mean, there are, when it comes to education, there are several different avenues that you can go down. What you have is there's a couple of credits that are available. One is the American Opportunity Credit, which is actually fairly recent. That's been within the last couple of years, and it replaced a previous credit called the HOPE credit. But in theory, American Opportunity is you're eligible for it if you're in the first 4 years of your schooling. I think you have to be at least a half-time student. There are some qualifications that you have to meet to get that. The plus about that credit is that it is a partially refundable credit. And what that means is, if you have a zero tax liability due to, other credits taking your tax down to zero, you can actually get part of that credit refunded on top of, your withholding or anything else that you might have. So that's the first type of credit. And of course, all these things are predicated on what is your adjusted gross income, because there are limitations with all of these from the standpoint of what can you deduct and what can't you. For those people who are not within the first 4 years of schooling, or they don't meet the other qualifications, you have a lifetime learning credit, and that one is not quite as good as American Opportunity because it's not refundable, but that is a credit that's available. And then another option is you can also choose to take a tuition deduction rather than a credit. And there are instances where, because of income limitations, that's the only option that's available to you.
And is there an income limitations on this tuition, how much you must earn in order to get it?
Yeah, there's income limitations on all of these.
Right, and it's really not how much you must earn. It's how much you're not allowed to exceed. So, for example, on the American Opportunity Credit, in the case of a single taxpayer, the credit is fully phased out with people with income over $90,000, and on a joint return, it's $180,000. Lifetime learning credit, those same phase-outs are $60,000 for a single taxpayer and $120,000 on a joint return. So these credits are designed for people that don't have large income levels. If you make $250,000, you're not going to qualify for any of these credits.
Probably don't need it.
Probably, well, money is money.
Yeah. But that's why these credits exist, is to help people move up.
Congress uses tax law to provide incentives to encourage certain types of behavior and to help the certain groups of people, and this is certainly an example of that.
Yeah.
So they each don't have to learn. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana. Line two, hi. Line two?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I'm just tuning in a little bit late, but and I'm not sure what you're.
We're talking about.
Yes,
we're talking about taxes with some experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated.
No, I understand. I don't know what their professions are, if they're CPAs or whatnot, but they may not want to hear this, but I'm absolutely in love with TurboTax. I'm self-employed, and I have a couple of different endeavors, so, you know, considered two different jobs. That's been the case for the last 4 years. I really love it. I don't know. It's almost like going online and doing some sort of video game.
Well, there's nothing wrong with TurboTax. I have a few clients who prepare either their own returns or children's returns on TurboTax and have me look at it. It's rare that there isn't something wrong with it. TurboTax is only as good as the information that you tell it. It's not, and I understand that it prompts you through the questions and leads you down the path, but it's not the same, at least in my opinion, as interacting with somebody who's been doing it for 30 years.
Sure, I can understand that.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I did have a question. What are sort of like some maybe horror stories that you've heard about it? I always get this audit protection because, you know, being self-employed and, you know, writing off vehicle use and stuff like that. I mean, these are typical things that are audit flags. Could you, I don't know, just give me some anecdotes that you might have in the negative for TurboTax, since I'm such a sold on it already.
I guess what I would tell you about TurboTax is TurboTax does fine from a computational standpoint. It's going to compute the tax correctly based on the information you give it. The horror stories that I've seen are where people simply don't give it the right information. So it's a typical garbage in, garbage out. And I've had people with we talked about stock options earlier. I've seen situations where people exercise stock options and don't provide the information and miss significant amounts of alternative minimum tax that they owed. So the downside, I would say, with any, whether it's TurboTax or Tax Cut or any of the other programs, is that it does a good job of computing tax, but there's significant opportunity to miss things. And in terms of any horror stories, I can't share any particular ones, but I would say that it gets back to the old adage of garbage in, garbage out. It's only as good as the information you give it.
I understand. And if you were sort of a savvy user, you could sort of opt not to give it certain information. I mean, this is not unlike going to a CPA and they say, I'm going to help you with your charitable organization donations with, say, you know, a place that takes clothes. Now, you did give a 55-gallon bag of clothes last year, right?
Well,
there were a lot of suits in there, right?
I would suggest that if you have a tax preparer who's leading you down that path, you should change tax preparers. It's not our job to create fictitious deductions, and I think that's all I'm going to say about that. I can't compete with cheating and don't intend to.
Yeah, let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana, line 3. Good morning.
Good morning.
What can we help you with?
My husband retired from the University of Illinois as a professor during 2010. And we normally deduct a fair amount of his professional expenses as miscellaneous deductions in Schedule A.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, what can we deduct this year? He retired in May.
Well, you can the rule says that you can deduct any ordinary and necessary business expenses that you incur in connection with the production of income. Certainly any expenses prior to his retirement would be deductible.
Only expenses up through May of this year because he retired in May?
Depends what he's doing after he retired. Many people still, did you say he was with the university?
Yes.
He may have emeritus status and still be doing work at the university.
Yes, but he is not being paid university.
Is he doing any consulting?
No.
Okay. Then I would say that once the income production activity stops, the rule would say that any expenses incurred after that date are no longer incurred in connection with the production of income, so you wouldn't be able to take those.
That is exactly what I thought.
Okay.
But my husband was more sanguine about what he might be able to deduct. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about taxes. Income tax returns due next month on April 18th for the IRS and the state of Illinois. So this morning we're joined by three tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated, Marty Verdick, John Breen, and Ann Bushman. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The phone numbers 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We've got a little breather here in the phone calls, so let's talk about a couple of things, Marty, that you said we should really be sure to talk about. And these have to deal with some things that we've been hearing about recently in the news here in Illinois, and that is the income tax rate went up, and we've also have a new law on the books that's been dubbed like the Amazon.
Well, it's not even a new law. Let's talk about the use tax.
Okay.
The state of Illinois, along with 48 other states, have a provision that says that if you buy items of tangible personal property and you buy them in a manner that you do not pay sales tax, either Illinois sales tax or another state sales tax at the time of purchase, when you bring it into Illinois and use it here, the term is place it into service in Illinois, it is subject to a 6.25% use tax. Now, that law has been around for a long time, and it was universally disregarded by most taxpayers except businesses. Yeah, the state of Illinois did audit businesses, but they never audited individuals. Well, in the effort to raise revenue, they said, wait a second, we need to collect this money. So they've now added a line item on your Illinois income tax return, and I think it's line 22. It's either 20 or 22. I've looked at so many now, I can't remember the line number, though. And basically, you've got to answer a question. You have to disclose on your Illinois return how much use tax you owe. And there are really three choices. Choice one would be, I owe zero. And I would use my parents as an example. They don't travel much outside the state. They don't buy things online. They go down to the local store and buy it. They pay tax. Zero is the good answer. The second answer is, I buy things not subject to tax, and Amazon is the reference that you used because mm-hmm. they're the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
When you buy things from Amazon, you don't pay sales tax on it. So you buy a camera, pay $1,000 for a camera on Amazon, you bring it into Illinois. Technically, you owe Illinois $62.50 of use tax, and you pay that with the return. So one of the choices on the Illinois return when you go through the worksheet is, yes, I bought things online, and I know how much I spent. Here it is. You compute the tax and add it in. The third choice is the choice that fits most of us. Yes, I bought things online. I didn't pay tax. I don't have a clue how much I spent. You can base the calculation on your adjusted gross income. And the computation would result in roughly $62 of tax on $100,000 of adjusted gross income. Now, not everything is subject to tax. It has to be items of tangible personal property. So if you go to Amazon and buy ebooks for your Kindle, the ebook is not subject to tax. Mm. But the purchase of the Kindle would be because mm-hmm. that's an item of property. The other example would be if you're vacationing in the Caribbean, you go to St. Thomas, and your wife drags you into one of the jewelry stores and walks out with a pair of diamond earrings, you bring them back to Illinois, you owe use tax on that. So this is a rule that's been universally ignored, which we can't ignore any longer because you're now signing a tax return under penalty of perjury
right.
with that information on it.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. The second thing that has changed is, as you all know by now or have heard, the state of Illinois raised their income tax rate from 3% to 5% effective January 1st, 2011. Because of that, the estimated payment requirements for those people who make estimated payments in the state of Illinois, traditionally, as long as you paid in 100% of prior year tax, you were protected. Because the tax rate in Illinois is going up by, we could get into the debate of whether it's 2 percentage points or whether it's a 66 2/3% tax increase, but because it's going up, you're to be protected for Illinois purposes, the estimated payments and withholding now have to equal 150% of the prior year tax. So if you simply set up estimated payments based on the prior year tax, when you file your 2011 return, you're going to be underpaid, and you'll be penalized for that.
Oh, okay. So
those are two items that are important to talk about.
Okay. Let's take another call, and then we've got an email question. A listener in Savoy on line one. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about S-Corp. I set up a corporation, and the date it was set up is December 30th, 2010. And the subchapter S election was done only last week, in March. the business started making money only after Jan 15th. My question is, I haven't filed the form 1120S for the taxes. Am I late for that?
Okay. The due date for an 1120S was yesterday, March 15th.
Correct.
The rule for filing a return says that for federal tax purposes, the corporation exists on the earliest of three dates: the date that the corporation first had assets, activity, or shareholders. The corporation, I believe you said, was formed in December of 2010.
Yes, correct.
So if stock was issued, it had a shareholder in 2010, so you meet one of the requirements. So technically, you do have a filing obligation for a 2010 S-Corp return. It would be blank because there's nothing on it. There's no activity. The S election that you just filed would be effective with the date of incorporation because you have up to 75 days following the date of the S of the incorporation to file the S election. So it would be an S corporation. So I would, if it were me, I'd suggest getting an S corporation return. There's not going to be any information on it other than just name, address, and ID number. But I'd get that thing in the mail.
Oh, so if I do it now, today, I may be okay?
Well, you're a day late, but the question is, better a day late than a week later, a month later, a year late when they catch it.
Okay.
Because if you get it in the mail today, you know, chances are good that nothing will come of it.
I see. Because I talked to one of the CPAs, and he told me that, don't worry, we will file the form, the 1120S, later this year because you had no income, so there is no need to rush to file by March 15th. And that is why I didn't do that yet.
It's an informational return, and I can't recall with S corporations, but I know with partnerships, even if there's no, because it's an informational return, there's a penalty that can be assessed based on the number of months it's late and the number of partners in a partnership. And I don't recall, and I don't know, Ann or John, do you recall if there's a similar penalty for S corporations?
I don't know that I've seen one assessed.
I know before. I've received assessments on partnerships, so uh-huh. I don't recall if an S corporation has a similar late filing penalty. So if it were me, I'd probably get it in the mail sooner rather than later.
So in that form, I just put my name, my address, and my EIN, and that should be it, right?
Well, if you had no activity, there's nothing else really to fill out. Everything
else
is
zero activity.
Yeah, nothing else is there.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. At least I'll do that then. Thank you very much for your help.
Mm-hmm.
You're very welcome. And here's an email question. The home buyer tax credit has been extended to April 30th of 2011, correct? This will go on next year's taxes, right? So this is a question about the tax owed in 2011 filed in 2012.
Well, and John's going to look this up real quickly. There is an extension of that for military personnel, but I honestly don't recall seeing an extension of the first-time homebuyer credit through the 2011 timeframe that's being referred to. It was certainly extended through May 1st of 2010. And again, I'm going to, if it's an extension, it may not be in the materials that we have with us.
Yeah,
if it was a recent
it.
Extension.
I mean, there is the one for government and military. Certain government and military personnel, which does go in to that May 1st, 2011 date that I think we talked about earlier. Or maybe we didn't. I mean, but that's the only thing that I see right now regarding an extension that goes into 2011.
Okay.
Yep. That would be one I'd have to check the latest to see if there's been some recent change. I don't recall seeing an extension.
Yeah. I was thinking that maybe if you were going to build a home, that if you had a certain amount of the deal underway.
It had to be under contract by that May 1st, 2010 date, and you have to have closed by October 1st.
All right. Okay. So let's take another call now. This is a listener in Effingham County, line 4. Hi.
Yeah. I would ask about that. I've seen where I've just sold some property, farm real estate, and I was wondering, is there any way I could transfer some money over so I wouldn't have to pay so much tax, like an RA? But the only thing is, see, I'm past 65, so I don't think that'd work, would it?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming you've received the money.
Yes.
Okay. So like-kind exchange is off the table. You've got the cash.
Mm-hmm.
Any any retirement contribution to an IRA or a KEO or a SEP would be based on, I mean, do you have any earned income or are you retired?
No, I had some earned income. I mean, you know.
You might be allowed to claim a deduction for either an IRA or a KEO or a SEP plan based on your earned income. It's not going to be a giant number. It depends, I don't know how much gain you want to shelter, but you know, certainly there are retirement plan opportunities, but the problem with those is that it, with the exception of the IRA or the what's called a SEP or SEP plan, those would have had to have been created by December 31st of last year. You have until the due date of the tax return to fund it, but the plan had to be in existence. Now, with an IRA, you mentioned you're age 65, so you could put up to $6,000 into what's called a traditional deductible IRA, assuming you meet the requirements. In the case of a SEP plan, do you have self-employment income or are you an employee?
No, this would have been self-employed.
Okay. With a SEP plan, the limitations for that are $49,000 that you could put into a SEP plan. Again, you can establish that anytime before April 15th and fund it by April 15th.
Okay, so, but in other words, I would still be able to deduct this off of this year's tax, right?
This year being 2010, yes. If we're talking about your 2010 tax year, you have until the due date of the return, April 11th, 2011, to establish and contribute to an IRA or a SEP plan if you have qualifying income and you meet the requirements.
What other plans could you do that? If I would buy a government bond or anything with that?
No. It's got to be a type of retirement plan to get a tax deduction. If you merely reinvest the money, that's not going to change your tax liability at all.
Okay, I was wondering about that because I've seen an ad. It sounded like to me that if you would invest in a bond, that you could take it off.
Nope, not the case.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Bye.
And next we go to Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
So we bought a house last year in June, and we got the $8,000 first-time home buyer. We amended our prior return and got that. And then this year we filed our taxes in February, and we're anticipating a return that was supposed to come electronically by March 1st. But now we have gone to the errors department, and they're telling us that when we contact the IRS that it's because of everyone who did this automatically goes there until they're cleared to make sure that they're not in a repayment, even though ours was the second one, like you said earlier, didn't have to be repaid. I'm just wondering if there's anything else to do or if we're just in a lost land and we just wait forever.
Well, here's my experience with these first-time homebuyer credits. Apparently, there was quite a bit of fraud involved with people claiming first-time homebuyer credits that didn't qualify. So last year, they began requiring a significant number of additional documents to be attached to the tax return where you claimed the credit. For example, you had to attach a copy of the settlement sheet to prove that you bought the house. Just a lot of those things that require manual processing. And what I believe that your situation is, have you you filed an amended return for 2009 claiming that refund? Is that correct?
Right.
Have you received that $8,000?
We did receive that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Because what I've seen happen is that as long as that amended return is pending and has not been processed, they, in many cases, will not process the current year refund until they get the prior year amendment processed to make sure that you don't owe any money and that you've satisfied all the requirements. Now, since they've already processed that, I've not encountered that situation where this year's refund is being held up. And I've had a number of clients who claimed the first-time homebuyer credit that we have filed this year's return, and I've not received any feedback that they're not getting their refunds in a timely manner. But I, you know, beyond that, I'm not sure. I can't think of anything else that it might be.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. This is Focus. We're talking about taxes this morning. If you've got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of email messages here now. The first one, we cashed in a mutual fund valued at about $15,000 in 2010. We contributed about $8,000 to the account, and the rest of the value was growth in the stock market. We are using TurboTax on a home computer to do our taxes. When we enter the mutual fund information, it shows our tax liability from the mutual fund cash at about $3,000. Does that sound correct, or are we missing something?
It doesn't sound correct. I've got a couple of ideas, but John or Ann, you want to kick in, John? I'll tell you what I'm thinking.
Well, what I'm thinking is that if they have reinvested their dividends, then their basis is probably actually higher than they think it is. I mean, that would be the first thing that I would take a look at, because what happens is in these mutual funds, if they're set up to reinvest the dividends, you don't actually get paid cash for the dividends over the years. What happens is they take those dividends and they buy additional shares of the mutual fund. You have a basis in those shares equal to the income that you've paid tax on over the years. So, for instance, if you've had this fund for 5 years and you've averaged, you know, $500 a year in dividends that were reinvested, you would have an additional $2,500 of basis that you would enter in as part of your cost basis into TurboTax. So I'm thinking that may be part of it.
I'm going to add on to one. Celeste, what did you say? That the value is 15, the investment was that they put in was 8?
Cashed in, mutual fund valued at 15. We contributed about 8 to the account.
Okay, so even using those numbers, there should be roughly $7,000 of gain, even disregarding the dividend reinvestment. The maximum, assuming that this mutual fund has been held for more than 1 year, the maximum rate of tax that they could pay for federal purposes is 15%, since it's a long-term capital gain. I'm betting that they've got this coded in TurboTax as a short-term capital gain, or they didn't put dates, specific dates, and the software is computing it as a short-term capital gain. And this gets back to the caller's example earlier of what can go wrong with TurboTax. Mm-hmm. Intuitively, I know that the tax cannot be more than 15% of that $7,000 of gain. It just can't be. That's $1,050.
Yeah, $3,000 is way too much.
Yeah, it's about triple what I would have expected. So something is clearly not entered correctly. And the first thing I'd look at is the holding period to make sure you've got it marked as long term.
Okay. And now we take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello.
What can we help you with today?
Okay, I hope this isn't too complicated a question. I have a rental property in another state, and it suffered a significant storm damage in the latter part of 2010. I negotiated a settlement with the insurance company, and I received checks from them in 2010 and 2011. Since it was out of state, I stayed there for some time in 2010 and 2011 to oversee repairs. And I did much of the repair work myself and used the money I saved in doing that to do some repairs beyond what was involved in the storm damage. So a couple things I'm wondering about. How do I deal with the different years? And how do I deal with the expenses I incurred with that? For example, lodging, travel, per diem.
Your first comment's probably the right one, and maybe this is a little bit too complicated for this forum, because
okay.
you've got about 5 or 6 different pieces to this question. It is possible that you could have if you reinvested all of the money, you won't have a gain on the insurance proceeds, but.
Right.
You've got state issues, you've got capitalization of your expenses while you were doing the repairs issues, you've got a variety of things going on that, given that the timing is probably beyond the scope of what we can really cover in this forum. I'm sorry, but it's you've got a your question is probably about a 15 to 20 minute answer at a minimum.
Okay.
We don't have that much time.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
Thank you.
But at least he got some good information that he needs to.
Yeah, you got to talk to somebody and get some help.
Yeah,
yep.
Get some help on that. 333-945-5 800-222-9455 will-talk@illinois.edu. This is kind of a general question. Can you talk about deductions available that might be available to staff employees of the University of Illinois that they might be missing when they itemize?
John, you want to cover that?
Well, as far as staff employees, I mean, generally, what makes up the itemized deductions for the most part are medical expenses, taxes, mortgage interest, charitable contributions, and then there's this kind of catch-all category, which is the subject to 2% of your adjusted gross income category. And, you know, a lot of things that people would probably be able to deduct would fall into that catch-all category. That would be things like union dues. That would be things like if you had to buy items for your employer that you weren't reimbursed for.
A lab coat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Those type things. Those fall under the 2% of adjusted gross income limitation. So a lot of times what we find is, you know, people do have these legitimate expenses that, you know, are deductible, but the problem is they can't exceed the limitation. And so, you know, it's really a case of most of what I think, you know, the people would be deducting would fall into that. And then it's just a question of can they get above the limitation.
Think of it as an insurance deductible. It's 2% of income. So if you have $100,000 of income, it's $2,000 that's, quote, the deductible. And until you get to $2,000, you don't get any tax benefit. So if you've got $1,300 of professional associations and education costs that are business-related, things like that, you'd still get no benefit.
Yeah.
And even if you get over the 2%, then you might have problems with alternative minimum tax because the miscellaneous itemized deduction category is not deductible for AMT. So it's not a lot of people get a benefit from these unreimbursed employee business expenses.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Sullivan on line 4. Hi.
Yeah, curiosity. Whenever you have farm ground and you rent it out for cash, do you have to pay FICA tax on that or self-employment tax since you do not participate in that ground?
No, you do not. Actually, whenever you rent something out for cash, it's actually reportable on a Schedule E. We've seen instances where people have reported these on Form 4835, which is farm rental. That form is really designed for crop share arrangements. If you are strictly a cash rent person, then it is not subject to FICA, and it's properly reportable on Schedule E on the tax return.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Sure.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus. We're talking about taxes. We have about 5 minutes left in the program. Maybe we get one more call, maybe two. Marty Verdick, John Breen, and Ann Bushman are with us this morning. My name is Celeste Quinn. What's the status of the credit for energy-efficient home improvements? The big deal was last year, but there's still a little bit this year we can take advantage of.
Okay. The energy efficient credits that were in existence in 2010 have expired. There are two types of credits. The first is the credit for the purchase of energy efficient improvements, doors, windows, insulation, exterior envelope of the structure to make it more energy efficient. That credit is limited to $1,500 of maximum credit, regardless of how much you spent. I had a client recently that put $20,000 worth of new doors and windows in their home, and they were a little disappointed that the credit was limited to $1,500. The other type of energy efficiency credit that's available is for alternative energy sources. Solar, wind, geothermal are the most common. And that credit is unlimited, and as I recall, it is a 30% credit of the total cost of the installation. The other distinction is that the energy efficiency credits for like solar, wind, and geothermal are available on new home construction. The credits for things like doors, windows, insulation are only available for improvements to an existing home. So you're not going to get a credit for putting energy efficient windows in your brand new home that you're building. You're going to get that credit to retrofit your old home that had leaky windows.
Right. Now I have something in front of me here that says next year, which means when we file in 2012, for this year, 2011, we could have a 10% credit for up to $500?
That, I have not looked at that because I haven't gotten, I mean, I'm just not into the 2011 credit
right.
yet. I know that the two credits, the $1,500 credit, that one is going away as of 2010, and it sounds like there used to be a credit similar to what you're referring to, which was a 10% credit on a much smaller number. And it sounds like it's the credit that is in place in 2010 is sunsetting and we're going back to the old credit.
Okay. Very good. We've got a listener here coming in on line 4, McLean County. And I think our same caller, McLean County.
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
Looked like there wasn't anybody else online, so I thought I'd call and ask.
Okay.
Because something I've always wondered about, and I'll make it very simple. explain to me alternative minimum tax.
Well, that's a simple question, but it's a difficult answer. Alternative minimum tax, as the name implies, is an alternative way of computing your tax liability. It starts with your total federal income. It's income after itemized deductions but before personal exemptions. But then you have to make some adjustments to that. For example, state and local taxes such as income tax and real estate taxes are not deductible in computing alternative minimum tax, nor are miscellaneous itemized deductions. And there's a whole laundry list of other things. That brings you down to a subtotal. From there, you subtract an exemption amount, and the remaining balance you multiply times a flat percentage of, is it 26 or 28%?
It depends on the income. Yeah.
And then you compare that calculation to your regular tax calculation, and you pay the higher of the two. So simple question. It's a complicated calculation. Unfortunately, it's one that's getting more and more people caught by surprise with this.
Okay. And I want to thank the listener for her question. And I think the takeaway for me this time out has been adjust withholding for my state income taxes because I'm going to owe more money could be penalized.
Your withholding will adjust automatically. The withholding tables in the state of Illinois adjusted automatically in January to take into account the higher tax rates. It's only those people that are required to make estimated payments that need to adjust their estimates.
Okay. Yep. Then I'm in the clear.
Yep. Okay. Good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, the three of you, for joining us this morning here on Focus. Marty Verdick and John Breen and Ann Bushman are all with RSM McGladrey Incorporated.